Hey there, Pastor Mark here. It's our prayer that this message would encourage and equip you in your relationship with Jesus. We're able to provide this content due to the joyful generosity of our financial partners. And if you'd be willing to join that tribe and help get some sermons like this around the world, you can donate at harvestbaptist.info/give. God bless. I have weddings on my mind recently. It is the season right now where you're going to weddings. It is the season where, as a pastor, you get the requests to do premarital counseling or to marry people roughly 6 to 12 months later. This is kind of that season where people get engaged over the summer and then they're reaching out to you. And I've probably had 3 or 4 of those conversations over the last month. I got a save the date yesterday, text to me, no more seals and calligraphy, text what came the save the date, and that was from Annabella, who's at Liberty University, and many of you would know Annabella, who before she went to college, attended church here, and babysit our kids regularly, and her and Colin got engaged, and they're getting married next summer, and they wanted us to save the date. Of course, last week, we had a wedding right out front of the church. Our very own Pastor Dave took Lauren to be his lawfully wedded wife. Shout out to Dave and Lauren in the service this morning. Congratulations. We had a great time at the wedding, celebrating and smiling and dancing, and just it was awesome. So weddings are on my mind right now, and I want you to picture, if you would, in your mind's eye, a wedding. I'll let you pick the venue, outdoor, indoor, whatever you want to choose. Just have it in your mind's eye and think about the day and what's happening. There's beautiful decorations. There's flowers. There's this white paper on a giant roll that's been rolled down the aisle so that the bride, the groom, everyone can walk down that. There's the wedding party in front of you. Everyone's smiling. The bride and the groom are holding hands, and they're looking at each other, and it's time for that magical moment that is the exchanging of the vows. And the groom looks at his soon-to-be bride and says, "I promise to love you as long as I feel like it." And not to be outdone, she looks back at him and says, "I promise to love you as long as it's easy." Now, you would be aghast if you sat there at that wedding. You know, grandma would stand up and protest, and "I'm not on my watch," you know. Like, you know, oh, this is a wedding. When we're promising love to each other, no, we're going a step further. We're doing real love here. We're doing for better, for worse, for richer, for poor, for in sickness and in health. Like, we're not doing this as long as I feel like it or as long as it's easy stuff, right? Picture a different scenario at a wedding. The mothers are seated, Cannon and Dee is playing. The bridal party comes down. The flower girls are dropping their petals. And then all of a sudden, the best man stands up. There's no groom, there's no bride, but everyone else is there. And he holds up an iPad, and there are the bride and groom sitting on their couch. And he says, "They've decided to join us virtually today. They're glad that you're here, but they're going to Zoom in and exchange their vows and get married over Zoom." You, too, would be aghast. You would say, "No. This is too important. What we're communicating right here, you need to be in the presence of witnesses and in the presence of God himself. We need to be together for this," right? If those sorts of scenarios sound bizarre or unfitting to you, then congratulations. You're already halfway to understanding what John's going to tell us here in the book of 2 John. Because he talks about the twin graces of love and truth and how love and truth are meant to be incredible dance partners. And he corrects this church that their love has overflown the banks of truth in many ways, and they actually are loving everyone indiscriminately, including false teachers, and he corrects them for that. But in this book, in the ending, as well as in the middle of it, he nestles several beautiful, wonderful, practical truths for how we can live love out. Love is such a squishy concept so many times in our minds and in our culture that John gives us super duper bottom shelf practical ways on how we can live our love out. And he tells us about love with a will, then he tells us about love with a face, and then he tells us about love with a family. Look, if you would, for a moment at verse number 5 of 2 John. He tells us about love with a will. The reality that obedient love is powerful love. Here's what he says in verse 5. I beseech you, lady. We've learned that lady is a metaphor for this church. Not as though I wrote a new commandment unto thee, but that which we have heard from the beginning, that we love one another. Verse 6. This is love, that we walk after his commandments. This is the commandment, that as ye have heard from the beginning, you should walk in it. Now, you may have picked up on a very common word in those two verses. The common word there is commandment. This is not a new commandment. This is the commandment that we should walk in. This is the commandment that we've heard from the beginning. Now, that's different than how we normally think of love. When he says commandment, we normally think of love as warm fuzzies. We think of love as being Twitter-pated, having these feelings that just compel us to go give to someone or be with someone or want to talk with someone or want to hug someone, these emotions that come out of us. But the Bible doesn't think of love in an emotive sense. The Bible really thinks of love in a practical, hands-on action sense. When he says, this is the commanded love, and you should love well, what he's saying is, this is dutiful love. This isn't love them if I feel like it. That's not what he's prescribing at all. He's saying we've had a commandment that we are to obey whether you want to or not, whether you agree with it or not, whether you think it's wise or not, whether you feel like it or not. And the commandment is that you should love them. You should take your love and push it in their directions. Now, feelings are important. I don't want to minimize feelings, but feelings are not what should guide our lives. He says there's a commandment that should guide our lives. And what is the commandment? Well, that commandment is to love them. The Bible goes so far as to say, and Jesus went so far as to say, that the greatest commandment was love. It was that we would love God with all we have all the time. That's my paraphrase. That we'd love him with our heart, mind, soul, and strength. But the second commandment, which is similar to it, it's likened to it, the second commandment is that we should love our neighbor as ourselves. We should have this vertical love for God, and that vertical love for God should push us into horizontal love for other people, namely our brothers and sisters in Jesus, but also those that are not of the household of faith, those that are just our neighbors that are unsaved, don't know the Lord, aren't interested, love them. Go love and love well. The scriptures go so far as to say, and Jesus went so far as to say, that if you did in fact love God, then you would keep his commandment to love other people. That you can't actually say that you love God if you don't love other people well. 1 John told us this, this is the love of God. What is the love of God? How do I show the love of God? What would I practically do? Or you put it this way, if you loved God, what would that look like? Would you sing songs to him? Would you give lots of money in his name? Would you serve a lot? Those all may be good answers, but here's what 1 John says. This is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. And his commandments are not grievous. You say, which commandments? Well, there's a lot of them, but Jesus said, if you love me, keep my commandments, and here's a new commandment, love them. It's the same principle. If you love me, then you're going to love them and love them well. Now, this is a bit of a conundrum for us because oftentimes we think that love is something that can't be demanded. The heart wants what the heart wants. You can't force me to love them. You can't force me to feel feelings for them. Oftentimes this is the case in a marriage where a husband or a wife will say, I just don't know that I love them anymore. I don't have the same feelings that I used to have. In newsflash, none of us have exactly the same feelings that we used to have. There is a roller coaster ride of feelings and emotions that happens inside of a marriage. And of course, the end goal is that there would be deeper, richer, more committed love to them in the end. But sometimes those Twitter-pated feelings go away and nothing comes in their stead and you feel a bit empty in relationship to your love. But the commandment is not based off of what I want to do. It's a commandment. And for Jesus to say, if you actually love me, you're going to keep my commandment and love them, he's not demanding that you feel a certain way. He's demanding that you do certain things, that your love would have an action, that you would put them first, that you would prefer them, that you would give to them, that you would help them, that you would do that with your spouse, that you would do that with your children, that you would do that with your neighbors, that you would love them well. And this, I don't think, is all that complicated to us truly. Because even in our love, we put descriptors on it or we put conditions on it. I'm like, it's not real love if it doesn't blank. This happens for me pretty regularly inside of our premarital counseling. We have a system of premarital counseling that a handful of us have been trained on at the church. And we all use really the same system where a husband-to-be and a wife-to-be take a survey independently of each other, and it takes their data and it compiles it into a report for us, and we do a very customized, personality-driven, their own kind of unique situation-driven premarital counseling. And part of that is there's a section that says, how do you define love? And it gives them a word bank of 20 to 30 words. And they have to take five words, their top five of love means this. And they have to rank them from number one to number two to number three to number four. And you know what the most common answer is? The most common answer looks like this. This is one of the premarital surveys that I don't have their name on it, but you get a screenshot of what they said. Both of them, independently of each other, had trust as number one. If you loved me, you'd trust me. Loyalty is on there. If you loved me, you'd be loyal. Honesty is on there. If you loved me, you'd be honest. You'd tell me the truth. These are practical ways that we work out love. Trust, it's not surprising that it's number one. And when Jesus says, if you loved me, you would keep my commandments, we may say it as, you would trust me enough to do what I tell you. Because my commandments, he says, are not grievous. My commandments are not meant to be nettlesome. My commandments are not meant to be unhelpful. My commandments are not meant to be something that will be a pothole on the road of life. My commandments are meant to be a boon and a boost and an assist to you. I'm trying to help you. I'm trying to give you what's best. And if you loved me, you'd trust me enough to do what I say because I'm telling you to do what's best for you. That's what he's saying. And we as Christians have this choice of, will I choose to love other people even when they're unlovely, even when it's hard, even when I don't feel like it? But John gives us a very practical tip of the hat when he says that love is oftentimes dutiful. It is tied to a command. True love, real love, will have a will. And honestly, it's powerful when you choose to love even when you don't feel like it. So love, practically speaking, is a choice. It is an act of volition. It is, I'm gonna show up in love because it's the right thing to do. And because I love God, I'm gonna love other people. You also find, though, that love has a face. This is the end of 2 John. These are the two verses we have not covered yet. And if you wondered if we could make a whole sermon on two random ending the book verses, then you'll be pleasantly surprised. We sure can. Verse number 12, having many things to write to you, I would not write with paper and ink, but I trust to come unto you and to speak face to face that our joy may be full. This is one of the most practical and pragmatic examples of balancing truth and love that you can find in all the scripture. John had some hard truths to tell this church, and he gave them at least a sneak peek on, hey, you're actually loving false teachers. Don't do that. But then he says, I have a lot more that I need to say to you. We don't know exactly what he wanted to say. Maybe he wanted to say, my fantasy football team is going well. I'm cheering for the Steelers opening game of the season. You know, I don't know. But it's presumable that he had more hard things to say to them. There was some correction in the middle of this verse that he just came out of in the middle of this book. And he says, I have a lot more that I could say, but I'm not going to write it down. I'm not doing it with paper and ink. I want to come look you in your eye. We need to have a conversation face to face. This method of writing it down, it's not going to serve us well. I want to look you in the face, and I want to tell you these things. Why? So that our joy may be full. I'm worried that if I don't look you in the eye and talk to you face to face, that this will dampen or diminish the joy of our relationship. And I don't want our joy to go down. I don't want our relationship satisfaction to go down. I don't want to hurt the relationship. So because I don't want to hurt the relationship, I'm going to wait, and we're going to have this conversation later, and we're going to have it at an appropriate time when I can look you in the eye and we can have the conversation face to face. That's what he's saying. This is so unbelievably wise. He tells us that love has a face, meaning some truths need to be spoken in the presence of love. Those of you that love to bear truth, but it's harder for you to live a life of love, you may make the mistake of doing drive-by shootings with your love bullets or with your truth bullets, where you text them the truth and you email them the truth and you talk to them about the truth, but you'll call them about the truth, you'll write them a letter about the truth, but you struggle to do it face to face. And John was wise enough to say, there are some truths that need to be spoken when we're in the presence of each other. I want you to feel my love. I want to look at you. I don't want to do it in this method. Now, if John understood the importance of face-to-face communication, when he had basically two options. In John's day, I can write you a letter and I could deliver it via a messenger or via a pigeon or something. Or I can look you in your eye and talk to you face to face. Those were the options. Think about how much more complicated this is for us, and that we now have a litany of other options that push us away from face-to-face communication. We now can write a letter. We now can type an email. We now can send a text. We now can call them on the phone. I don't know if we can still send telegrams, but perhaps we can still send a telegram. We have the ability now to FaceTime or to Zoom, which is better, and you at least get to see their face, but it is not the same thing as being in their physical presence, where you can read all of their body language and you can smell them and you can like be with them. It's not the same. There are all these avenues for communication, and I'm not ungrateful for those avenues. They all have a purpose, and they all can be used really well. I'm not besmirching technology this morning, but I am pointing to a reality that John seemed to understand, and he communicates to us that not all conversations are meant to be had in any methodology you want. The means by which you communicate, especially if it's a harder conversation, is very important, and John wanted to tilt to face-to-face very, very heavily. In our world, everything tilts towards digital, but John was willing to say, I want to have this conversation face-to-face with you. You take our complicated world right now that is all these different methods by which we can communicate, and then you add to our world the new reality that is not just approaching, but is in fact here, of artificial intelligence, and it gets even more complicated for us. Because we're to the point now to where I don't even know if I'm talking with a human sometimes when I think I'm talking with a human. I thought I was texting with them, but it actually was the company's chat bot. I, this week, listened to several AI salespeople, and not an actual person, but a machine, but it's a sales force that you can hire, and they had demonstration calls where they called live people, and this robot talked to them in strikingly similar ways to a human. It used to be that when you call the company and you get the machine, right, that answers and says, press 1 for English, and you roll your eyes and say, we're supposed to speak English, it's America, dang. And then you press 3 for this and 4 for this, representative, and you finally get to someone, right? You knew you were talking to a robot. Now, I mean, these sales calls were amazing. This AI agent sounded so human. It was uncanny. It was us and ums and just so natural and so flowing that you couldn't tell if it was someone or not. You really couldn't. We're not quite there yet, but we will be in the near future. We will have the ability to have an AI-generated image and video of ourselves that is your image and your voice talking and doing whatever you told it to do or perhaps didn't tell it to do, and it will be talking on your behalf, but it won't be you. It'll look like a video of you, but it won't be you. That is something that we are living in right now. that complicates communication for us. It does. Over the summer, I was interviewing someone for a position here at the church, and we were meant to do it over Zoom. We couldn't be in person, so Zoom or FaceTime is my second choice if I can't be in person. And about 30 minutes before the interview, they messaged me and said, hey, something's happened with my camera, and I can't do the video, but I think I can jump on Zoom and we can talk. So basically, it's a phone call at this point. So we're talking, I'm asking them some questions, and I'm getting responses back, and it feels like they're reading. They're giving me responses that are like very much in association to with what I just said. It's not a script. I can tell it's not a script, but it really feels like they're reading something and not talking. And we're talking, I'm asking, and I'm getting a little bit puzzled. And finally it dawns on me, I think they have an AI agent listening into this conversation, that they have audio turned on to ChatGPT or whatever it is. And I'm pretty sure it's getting my questions in live, feeding them responses. And I think they're just reading the responses that the AI platform is giving to them. So I stopped and I said, I have a hunch that perhaps you're reading prompts from some sort of artificial intelligence, something that it's telling you to say to me and you're spitting it back to me. Is my hunch accurate? And they chuckled a little bit. They said, I can neither confirm nor deny that, kind of sheepishly. And I said, listen, I admire your creativity and ingenuity, but I need to have a conversation with you, okay? So turn that off. And we talked for maybe 3 more minutes. The interview was done. We didn't have another one. They didn't get hired, you know, it was real easy. But it was this new moment that was like, I'd never dawned on me that this would be part of my communication, right? And I think whether their camera actually worked or not, I don't know. But I think if they were on camera, I would have picked up on it very quickly. And they didn't want to be face to face so they could communicate in this way. Now, this is not to say that all technology or AI is bad. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm just trying to point to the reality that conversations and communications for us, it has been more complicated than it used to be perhaps for John, and it's growing increasingly complex. That's the reality that we live in. Those are the waters we swim in. Like it or not, AI is here to stay, okay? Whether you want it to or don't want it to, and as a rule of thumb, all of the surveys and the data say, and this is overly simplistic, I know, but as a rule of thumb, if you're above 40, you tend to be more scared of AI, and if you're under 40, you tend to be more excited about it. And that obviously causes lines of division in our culture and in our churches and all those sorts of things. But the communication waters that we swim in today are very complex. I do want to take a moment and just say a quick word about artificial intelligence in general. And this is going to be very simple, but hopefully helpful. Christians have long sought to speak into cultural moments and what's happening around us with intelligence and with a biblical paradigm. This would apply itself to all kinds of issues that surround us, but artificial intelligence is one of those right now. And I do fear that Christians on the whole are talking about these sorts of tools and technologies and overly simplistic ways, in ways that are not intelligent, and it doesn't actually help us converse with the world around us. It's not uncommon for me to hear a Christian say or post on social media like, AI is bad. It's a tool of the devil. The Antichrist will use it to take advantage of people one day. And it's like, that's way too simple. And there does need to be some sort of intelligence. Even when we talk about artificial intelligence, that is a very broad umbrella word that covers a whole host of systems and models and applications of those models. Like, that's a very broad term. It would be like if I said, I am fearful of transportation, or I'm excited about transportation, you would think, what does transportation mean? Do you mean a bicycle? Do you mean a car? Do you mean you're fearful of planes or buses or submarines or mopeds or scooters? Like, transportation is a very broad term that covers a whole lot of different applications. That makes sense? AI is a very broad term that covers a whole lot of applications, but it's important for Christians to think through what is appropriate, what is ethical, what is biblical. We actually did, I led a session on this with our staff team back here in August for our staff orientation. We spent about an hour and a half working through how we would ethically or unethically do's and don'ts on using technology and specifically AI tools and applications. And the big headline there was, ministry is supposed to be personal. Technology can feel cold and impersonal. And if there is technology, even something that's AI generated, that takes low-level tasks off of our plate and frees us up so that we can spend more time in face-to-face moments that discipleship is made of, then let's leverage that so we can go have face-to-face time with people. But if there are things that are diminishing or moving us away from relationship, or it's talking to people on our behalf so that we don't have to, that's moving us away from relationship and away from face-to-face time with people, and let's try to avoid that. And if you're more curious about that, we have a whole AI, like literally ethical usage policy that we have for our staff team, and we'd be happy to share that with you. The point is this. The point is that, number one, we should think ethically and biblically and intelligently about what we're facing as a culture. But the point is also that what we're facing as a culture moves us away from face-to-face communication. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. It moves us away from interaction with people. And a wise person who wants to love well will understand I can't communicate everything in my life face-to-face. That's impractical. I'm not suggesting you refuse to email at work and you must go to your boss's office and talk to them. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying don't ever text people or don't write a letter to someone. Those all have appropriate usage. But what I am saying is there are moments and conversations that have to be had face-to-face or they don't work. And you will ruin the joy of relationships, and you will erode your relationships if you don't learn the art of having a hard conversation face to face. This is something that parents need to teach their children. If you grew up without a cell phone in your pocket and texting people left and right, and you got through high school like I did without cell phones and smartphones being pervasive, you probably learned how to have face-to-face conversations with people. Because back then, if you wanted to ask her out, you had to do it face-to-face. I mean, you could have called her, but probably you asked her out face-to-face. And you had to go through that awkward, you know what I'm talking about? That like, I'm putting myself out there, but I get to read your face in the moment, and I get to see it, and she has the awkward moment of, do I want to say yes or no? And if I have to say no, how do I let them down? And now that's all DMing people or texting people. Like, young people don't do that anymore. So you probably, if you're my age or older, you have a bit of a knack for this that our younger people are not having, and it's imperative to us that we teach them. If you love someone, some conversations you have to have face-to-face. I preach this to our staff team, that if you have to have a hard conversation, someone's mad at you, a parent in the school emails you angrily, or you have to confront a behavior, do not do that in written form. Our rule is face-to-face is what we're aiming for. Over the phone or Zoom is acceptable, but not preferred. But text or email or letter chains back and forth are unacceptable because it doesn't work. There's actually some data and science that's been put around this that they say 93% of our communication is nonverbal. Meaning 7% is the words you choose, and over 90% is your body language and your tone and your timing, and it's not the actual words that you use. So when you rely on a text or an email or something like that to communicate a hard truth, you're working with 7%. 90% of what you would want to work with to communicate your heart in this moment is gone and robbed from you, and it just doesn't work well. And I think that we've all experienced this, where you've had a boss who, when they're angry, they just email everyone instead of actually having a conversation about it, or you have a spouse who loves to argue with you over text instead of having a face-to-face conversation about it. And I guarantee you, I bet my bottom dollar, that does not go well, it doesn't sit well with you, you don't like it, and it leads to more drama and more turmoil. Why is this? Well, because practically, this is so practical. Love has a face. Some conversations have to be in the presence of love. You say, okay, Pastor, then help me. Which conversations? Which ones? Well, take a survey of the scriptures with me. There are moments in the scripture where it is inconvenient for people to be face to face, but they bend over backwards to be face-to-face because they have to have a heavy conversation. One of those is correction. Think about Nathan the prophet with David. He didn't send him a letter, but he told the king to his face, which was a dangerous game to play. That king could dice you up in a heartbeat. He told him, "You're the man. You're the guilty one," and he corrected him. Think about the first correction we have in all the Bible. Adam and Eve sin, they do wrong. And what does God do? God comes into the garden with his presence, and Adam and Eve hide from the presence of God because they don't want the awkward conversation about the wrong they've just done. But God draws them out from their hiding behavior. He doesn't say, "Oh, you're playing hide and seek, I'll send an angel, I'll write it on the tree and I'll leave a message and a memo for you." No, he finds them and he talks to them face to face. You think about not just correction, but reconciliation. Remember Jacob and Esau in Genesis 33, where Jacob had wronged Esau and he wanted to make it right, and he knew he had to do it face to face, and he was nervous as all get out about it. Jacob was scared. He was petrified to have this conversation face to face. If you read the account, he's sending his servants and he's sending his wife and he's sending his kids. He's trying to soften Esau up as much as he can because his heart is racing and he does not want to have this conversation face to face. And credit to Esau, when Jacob shows up, Esau hugs him and embraces him and forgives him, and he makes it so easy on Jacob. But Jacob knew, "I can't reconcile with my brother through a messenger. I can't send my servant. I can't send my wife or my kids to do it on my behalf. I've got to see this guy face to face." I read an article in The Guardian this week. It was written back in August, and the title was, "I've Been Stupid and I Miss You." It was stories of people who buried the hatchet with their relatives and their friends after years of silence. One of them was a story of a boy named Choi. He was a man at this point, I guess. Choi, when he was 17, he had a rocky relationship with his dad. And he was late for curfew one night, and his dad locked the doors and said, "You can't come in the house, sleep outside. You're late for curfew." And that was it. It was the straw that broke the camel's back for Choi. And he said, "I don't need this in my life. I'm done with this. I'm 17. I'm out of here." And he left, and he never came back. He didn't talk to his dad. He didn't write his dad or his mom. They had no communication. It was as if he was dead to them. He was gone. Decades went by. Choi's now in his 40s. And Choi has this, as a son would have, he has this inclination to go reconcile and make things right with his parents. Even though he feels he was wronged in many ways, he wants to go make it right. So he finally made the decision one night, "I'm going to do this." And he jumped in his car. I believe it was 5 or 6 hours he drove. And that scary, as you can imagine, a hard moment to walk up to the door and to knock on the door and to not know what they're going to say or do, but he knew he needed to be there face to face. He knew there was no chance of reconciliation if he wasn't face to face. And his dad opened the door, and his dad did not have a great response. He looked at his mom and said, "Who is this person?" He knew who he was, but it was his way of saying, "I don't have a son anymore." His mom came to the door, urged them to talk. They began to talk. He was invited in, and little by little by little, they began to restore their relationship. And Choi chronicles the ups and the downs, and his dad is now dead, and his mom now lives with him. But it was a story of, he knew intuitively deep down, this is a conversation I have to have face to face. I can't text, I can't find their number and call them. I gotta do this one in person. So reconciliation. Jesus did this with Peter. Peter denied him three times and he showed up on a beach and he got face to face with Peter and said, Peter, do you love me? He reconciled with him and he restored him, but he did it face to face. You find that warnings are oftentimes situations where this is a heavy conversation. I gotta warn you about something. If I can do it face to face, I need you. I need to do it this way. Paul did this in Acts chapter number 20 with the Ephesus elders. He called them over to Miletus to have a face-to-face conversation with them to warn them that wolves in sheep's clothing were going to enter into the church and that they needed to be on guard. And it was one of those conversations that he didn't want to have, even though he did write them a letter, the letter to the Ephesians, and we have it in our scriptures. This was one that needed to be face-to-face. It wasn't a letter conversation. You also find that there's just grievous or serious words. Words of grief, or maybe just a serious moment. That could take a lot of different shapes and sizes. That could be God communicating the commandments to Moses face to face. This could be Paul with the Ephesian elders telling them he was no longer going to see them again, and they cry and they weep and they hug each other. But there are some moments and just some conversations that you got to see each other. You got to be able to read each other's body language. It's just a serious moment. I was pleasantly surprised, impressed, and blessed when a few years ago my father had a stroke. And this was on, I think, a Tuesday, if memory serves me right. I got the call that Dad had a stroke, and us boys all started converging to Louisville, where my parents are from all over the East Coast, me and my brothers. And not knowing how serious it would be, you know, getting there and finding out this was not terminal, but it also was very serious and something that my dad still lives with, many limitations and handicaps, you know, to this day because of it. But I can remember being in the ICU. This was close to the COVID years, and they were crazy on their rules of who could be there and not be there, which we completely ignored. I hate to be a rule breaker, but it was like, you know, the spouse and one other, you know, sibling can be in here. And we just opened up side doors and let each other in and snuck in, and we all, you know, spent time there. But friends would show up, and it was such a blessing to see people that I haven't seen in years but have been lifelong friends with my mom and my dad show up and be there physically. I remember being particularly blessed and impressed that my father-in-law, my wife's husband, who lives in California, had heard that this was happening, and we had asked him to pray, and he made the decision that he was driving to the airport, he was getting the first plane that he could find, and he flew to Louisville from California, spent probably 2 or 3 hours with my dad in the ICU, and jumped on a plane and went back to California. It was just one of those moments of like, this, even though I'm not his blood family, I'm his family by marriage, and if my family by marriage, his father is hurting, I'm gonna show up, not just for my dad, but for me in many ways. And it spoke volumes that someone would be present. And we got lots of texts and lots of phone calls and lots of those things, which were also meaningful, but not in the same way as someone being there face to face. What is this communicating? It's communicating the simple idea that some truths, some moments require you to be there face to face. So I would put it this way. Truth demands you say the right things, but love demands that you say them the right way. And there's lots that goes into that. You have to think about your method of how you're going to communicate. Honestly, your method is just as important many times as your message. It's not enough just to say the right things or the truthful things or the doctrinally correct things. You have to communicate them in a way that people will receive them. You have to think about, here's a few things, your timing. Is it the end of a long work day? Are they hungry? Are they tired? Pick the right timing. You have to think about your tone. Not just what you're saying, but how you're saying it. You have to think about the medium. Is this text? Is this an email? Is this a phone call? Is this face-to-face? I will say, like, if you're a couple in the room and you tend to fight in a way that isn't face-to-face, that you fight and duke it out over text, or you fight and duke it out over email, or even over the phone, you are doing a disservice to your relationship, and your joy will be diminished because of that. It's going to be helpful if you do it face-to-face. Think about body language. All of these go into a conversation. And the point is, John was wise enough to know my love has to limit me from writing some things, and we got to be together. But you also find that love has a family. Love is a will, love is a face, love is a family. Last verse, the children of thy elect sister, they greet thee. Amen. Now, we learned in verse 1 that the woman and her children was a church and the congregants of the church. So when this says your sister and her kids, this is talking about what we would call a sister church and the congregants of that church. This is talking about more or less maybe crosstown churches or churches that are separate and independent from each other, but still caring for each other. What this does in the last verse is it testifies to the concern and the interest that different churches had for each other. I would put it this way. A healthy church will have a healthy concern, not just for themselves, but even for other churches. And you see that testified here in verse number 13, where John says, hey, I'm sending you my letter, my love, my greetings, but there's a whole other church, and they want to send you their greetings and their love, and they want to say hey to you as well. This is something that has been convicting to me in recent years. So I'm going to confess my sins to you this morning. This is, on a corporate level, something that churches like ours are pretty bad at, if I'm honest. When you say churches like ours, what do you mean churches like ours? Well, we're an autonomous church or an independent church or a church that isn't connected in any sort of legal sense to any denomination. Many churches, if not most, belong to a band or a tribe of other churches. There's the United Methodists, or there's the Presbyterians, and there's kind of several buckets of Presbyterian, the PCA or the PCUSA. There's Southern Baptists, or there's Free Will Baptists, or there's Roman Catholic, or there's, and when you are a part of that tribe, you automatically know who your sister churches are. Because they sign the same doctrinal statement as you. If you're part of the Assembly of God, then they sign the Assembly of God doctrinal statement. There's someone from the Assembly of God who does some coaching and kind of works with all of you, and you're connected in a network. Now, we're autonomous. We have no plans of changing that. There's no conversation. We love being autonomous because it gives us so many advantages, but we have to be real about it and say it does give us some disadvantages. It's not like there's none. And one of those disadvantages is you don't know who your sister churches are. You're at a loss as to, well, who's part of my tribe and not part of my tribe, because no one ever formally raised their hand and joined arms with each other. So some of that becomes easy, where you say, okay, here are missionaries that we support in Honduras and in Nicaragua and in China, and their churches that they're pastoring we're connected to, because we're giving them money and we're getting updates and we're funding them. And we do a great job of this. Honestly, we do better than most churches at this, if I'm honest. We a couple weeks ago had one of our missionary partners in Honduras, and they have an orphanage, a children's home there in Honduras. And they emailed some of their partners and they said, it's been a long time that we've had the children's home. We've never had air conditioning. It's 90 plus degrees pretty much every day here. And we'd love to install air conditioning in these rooms so that our kids can sleep more comfortably. It's going to be in the neighborhood of $35,000. And we said, sign us up. Here's $5,000. I think your other churches are going to chip in as well. But if you fall short, come back to us and let us know. But let's be a part of this. And we wrote them a check for $5,000 here a couple weeks ago because of your generosity. We do stuff like this all the time. And that's something we're good at. We're our missionary partners. They're our sister churches, even though they're like in another country, right? We have some church planters that are in different states, like away from us, that we've funded and we've helped them plant their churches. Josh Skelly is one of those right now who grew up in our church and is planting a church in Tampa, Florida, and is doing a tremendous job, and we send him money every month. We do that. Okay, it's pretty easy to know. That's our sister church. We would know that there's people who worked on our staff team and they served you, or perhaps you weren't here yet and they served other congregants of Harvest, but they were on our pastoral team and they've left us to go pastor and be the lead pastor of their own church. I think of Pastor Delaney in Florida and Pastor Skelly, who's in Virginia. I think of Pastor Gunner and Pastor Lehman and those that were on our church staff team that were here. Think of Travis and Teslin, Pastor Burgett, who's in Indianapolis, who they got to cut their teeth on ministry and they got to learn ministry and then they got to go pastor and lead a church of their own in a different place. We would say, man, that's our sister church. We love them. We're for them. Let's support them. Let's bless them. Let's pray for them, right? But here's where it gets tricky. What about the churches in Natrona Heights and Sarver and Katanning and around us? This is where churches like ours are bad. And I'm not going to say that it goes so far as to say, well, those other churches are like our competition. I know some churches that think that way, and it's very unhealthy. I actually had lunch with a local pastor 2 weeks ago, and we had a good lunch, but he mentioned pretty quickly in the conversation, I'd never met him before. He mentioned, I know you're my competition, and it bugged me, but I didn't say anything. And then he said again a few minutes later, I know we're competition, and it bugged me more, but I still didn't say anything. And then he said it a third time, and I couldn't resist any longer. I said, time out. We are not competition. I am not against you, and you are not against me. We are not at war with each other. We are not competing with each other. We are on the same team. And you go reach people, and I'll reach people, but let's try to bless people and have them know Jesus as best we both can. And if I can be a help to you, or if our church can be a help to you, please let me know. We'd love to be, like, we're on the same team. But it gets tricky that you don't know sometimes, like, not every church is a good gospel preaching church, but you also have to acknowledge that doesn't mean that there's none out there. But we thank God for what he's doing, like, in our midst. I thank God that, like, it's a little difficult to find a seat this morning and some folding chairs got set up. I thank God that it's not because the second service was, like, empty and everyone came to this one. It was a lot of people there. I thank God for what's happening in that construction and for the school and the kids that are being educated and for the literally dozens and scores of people over the last couple months that have been baptized and all that God's doing in our midst. I thank God for that. But let's not think for 1 second that we have a corner on the market when it comes to God's presence and that God only meets with us and only blesses us and only wants to help us and that he doesn't want to bless other churches. Like, there's a network and a team, and you have to recognize there's sister churches. And a healthy church will say, okay, that's not my competition. Those are my brothers and sisters in Jesus. And we may not dot every I the same. We may not cross every T the same. We may not have the same style of worship music. We may not have the same number of pastors on the staff or so many other things. But if they preach the gospel in Jesus' name and they're authentically trying to help people and see lives be put back together and changed, and they have a pure gospel, then that's enough, right? We can disagree on a whole host of second tier issues and God can sort that out when we get to heaven, but we're all gonna be in heaven together. We're all gonna be worshiping together. So let's treat each other like we're on the same team. Let's not shoot each other in the back. I was personally convicted about this. I'll give you a couple ways that it's manifesting itself in my way and in our corporate life, Lord willing. Personally, I get a lot of invites, I can't say a lot, but enough, from local pastors where it's, here's the pastor's prayer breakfast, or here's the pastor's luncheon, or just a local pastor reaching out and saying, you want to get coffee, you want to get lunch, and for years, my response has been, thank you so much, I'm good. That's basically been my response, not quite that curt, but from my perspective, I'm okay. I do have a network of pastors kind of in other areas that I talk to very regularly. I spent, I don't know, probably an hour and a half on the phone with a pastor from Texas this week. I probably spent 20 or 30 minutes with a pastor from Connecticut this week. Like, I have a sounding board that's around me, and I enjoy time with you. I would rather go camping with you than hang out with a bunch of pastors all day. I really would. There's other pastors on our church team. I don't feel lonely. I don't feel like I don't have friends. Like, I'm good to go. I don't feel like I need a pastor's fellowship personally. But God convicted me and said to my heart, what if this isn't about what you need? What if this is about what they need? What if they're pastoring a church of 50 people and they feel super lonely right now? And they just want someone to help them and kind of commiserate for a little bit about the pressures of pastoral ministry, or someone to rejoice with them about what's happening. And I'd viewed all these requests through, what do I need? I don't need it. I'm good. And my paradigm just shifted to a, well, what if they need it? And that's hard, because that can't be to the disservice of you. I'm here to pastor you, not to pastor other pastors. But there's a balance to be had there of, like, you can spend time investing and helping, mentoring. There's lots of people that have mentored me and us, and we're at the spot where we're able to mentor some other people now. And to take that and to pass it on and to have a healthy mindset. For me personally, I've done more pastoral lunches, breakfast, coffees, phone calls than I ever have before. And it's been a blessing to me, honestly. I've been a recipient of having that blessing come my way, trying to bless other people. But even us as a church, we'll talk more about this in Missions Month, but we've been so good internationally for so many years. And we want to take that strength that is international and actually bring it to bear, even on, like, regional, and trying to bless other churches in our region. We've done a bit of this in recent years, and that I can tell you of Hilltop Baptist and buying their sound system for them, or Legacy Baptist and giving them $20,000 towards their building fund, or paying for their permits for their building, or trying to bless other places. But we actually want to do more of that. I have a heart to see churches planted in our region, but the more I'm in this region, the more I think you may not need to plant a fresh church. There's probably churches that are there and they have a building and they have a handful of 15 people, and maybe they could be fostered, and you just put them under your wing and help them and see them. And I don't even know how all that's going to pan out. We're having conversations behind the scenes and trying to plan for the next 2, 3, 4 years and working through that. But here's what I do know. There should be a heart for a church to say, we got a family. Not just our family right here, but there's other churches that are our family, and we're for them, and we support them, and we pray for them, and we want to try to bless them, and we want to be in their corner.